So what have you been learning about Abraham? We've been on this journey in the life of Abraham, and it is not simply to fill in the blank spaces so that you can talk about Abraham and not be embarrassed if somebody asks you a question. The reason why we've been on this journey in the life of Abraham is because of friendship. God takes a man, Abraham, meets him in Ur, when Abraham is a pagan, an idol worshiper, and draws this man into faith and ultimately into friendship. And the reason why we've been on this journey in the life of Abraham is so that we can understand how it is that God takes us into friendship as well. And this morning we're going to look at a passage that is probably one of the more well-known stories about Abraham, but from the video, maybe it's not that well-known, but one of the more well-known stories about Abraham, and it is the sacrifice of his son Isaac. It, in fact, is described in Genesis 22 as God's test for Abraham. Now, when you think about tests, so what comes to mind? I think that for most of us, if you think about a test, tests are not good things. I mean, if we were to poll the students in the room, all of you that are taking classes, high school, middle school, college, hey, you want more tests? The response is definitely not. You know, tests, it seems like the tests you take in school, it's almost as if, and my apologies to any teachers in the room, it seems like almost as if the tests are to prove what you don't know. I mean, it often feels that way when you're taking the tests. I know I just recently finished my comprehensive exams for my PhD program, and it really felt like that. They're going to trap me. They're going to ask stuff that I don't know. That's how I felt in preparing for the tests, that the test was really a bad thing. It was to prove what I didn't know. And oftentimes I think we have that sense of tests. They're negative things. They're bad things. For example, if you go to the doctor's office, you're in for your regular physical, and the doctor turns to you and says, "We need to run some tests." Now you know, oh, he found something, and he's not sure about it. They run those tests only because there's something wrong, right? And there's that tendency to think the tests are a bad thing. Or let's say you dropped your car off at the mechanic, right? And just lube, oil filter, just the normal kinds of thing. And then you get a call from the mechanic, and the mechanic says, "Can we keep your car for a few more hours? We need to run some tests." What do you think? You can watch dollars go away, you know, as you're thinking, they're running tests. They must have found something bad. And I think the tendency is to think about tests as if they're a bad thing, that there's a negative connotation to the tests. And I think that's sometimes the way that we think about what goes on with Abraham in this episode that we're about to read, where it talks about God testing Abraham. What I want to do before we actually read the passage, though, is perhaps change our thinking a little bit about what it means for God to test somebody. So rather than starting with Genesis chapter 22, where it says that Abraham tested God, I want to back up and just ask the question, what does it mean when God tests somebody? And what I want to do is I want to dip into a few other passages in the Old Testament to see where that language is used, to see if we can't think a little bit differently about what it means to be tested by God. So I'm going to start in Exodus chapter 20. Exodus comes quite a bit later in the story of the nation of Israel, that is the descendants of Abraham. They have gone into Egypt. They have grown up there. They have been in slavery and bondage there. And ultimately God delivers them from the bondage of Egypt and leads them out on a journey to what is the promised land, the land that God had vowed to give to Abraham and his descendants. And as they are on this journey, God leads them to Mount Sinai. And there, on Mount Sinai, God is going to give them instructions about life with him. And God visits the mountain in a really profound way, powerful way. Thunder and lightning and clouds and fire. And Moses, the leader of the children of Israel, is talking to God on the mountain and explaining what's going on to the children of Israel. And there's an interesting exchange that happens between the children of Israel and Moses in Exodus chapter 20. Starting in verse 18, all the people saw the thunder and lightning and flashes and the sound of the trumpet and saw the mountain, Mount Sinai, smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood at a distance. And then they said to Moses, "Speak to us yourself, Moses, and we will listen. But don't let God speak to us or we're going to die." They were afraid of what was going on the mountain. And Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid, for God has come in order to test you. And in order that the fear of him may remain with you so that you may not sin." So here this idea of God testing the people comes up. And the question is, what's going on here? Is God trying to reveal something bad in the hearts of the people? Nope, that's not what the test is about. Is God setting them up for failure? No. Is he looking to uncover some evil hidden secret? No. this idea seems to be that God is working to give them the opportunity to fully trust Him. That's what it's all about. God is inviting them in this encounter to come to the place where they would more fully trust Him. This test is not about what's wrong with them, but is an invitation to grow into what is right. That's part of what we see here. Go a little farther into the Old Testament, into the book of Deuteronomy, next couple of books over. Deuteronomy chapter 8. Deuteronomy is a collection of three messages that Moses, that guy who was speaking at Mount Sinai, three sermons that Moses speaks to the children of Israel before they settle in the land. And Moses is recapping what God has done and what God intends to do. And he talks about God's testing in Deuteronomy chapter 8. Chapter 8, verse 14. Moses is speaking about what's going to happen as the people settle in the land. And in chapter 8, verse 14, he says, "It's possible that your hearts will become proud, and you will forget Yahweh, the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. And He led you through the great and terrible wilderness." He's referring to their wandering in the wilderness for a period of time. "He led you through the great and terrible wilderness with its fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty ground where there was no water, and He brought water for you out of the rock of flint. And in the wilderness He fed you manna, which your fathers did not know, in order that He might humble you and that He might test you to do good for you in the end. Otherwise, you may say in your heart, 'My power and the strength of my hand has made me this wealth.' But you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is He who is giving you power to make this wealth, that He may confirm His covenant, which He swore to His fathers, as it is this day." Test. Moses is saying God is testing you in that wilderness wandering. What's going on? It's not, you all are really wicked and I'm going to expose that. It's not, there's a secret thing in your heart that I want to reveal. The test was so that you can grow to trust me. The test was not to display what was wrong, but in its sense, to give them the occasion to embrace what they wanted to believe about God. In a sense, to give them space in their lives for God to do good to them without them boasting. For them to affirm, no, it's you, God. It's you who's done this. It's all about you. That's what this test was about. There's one other place in the book of Deuteronomy where this idea of test comes up. It's in chapter 13. Slightly different context. Again, part of Moses' message to the people. In chapter 13, verse 1, Moses is speaking and speaking for God and says, "If a prophet or a dreamer of dreams arises among you and gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder comes true concerning which he spoke to you, saying, 'Let us go after other gods whom you have not known, and let us serve them,' you shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams, for the Lord your God is testing you to find out if you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul." What is this testing about? He's not saying, oh, you all are wicked, there's something wrong in your soul. No, what's coming is the opportunity to betray, to display, I really am committed to the Lord God above all else. And so when you think about God's testing, and as we read this account of Abraham being tested by God, I want you to think about it. God's testing is the, I guess you could say, it's for those who are in relationship with Him. He is giving them the opportunity to put on display their high regard for Him. The tests that God brings are the opportunities that He sets up for those who are in relationship with Him to display, to manifest the high regard they have for Him. It's not about showing what you don't know, what you don't have. It is about owning what you do believe and finding a way to express that. That's what we see in these examples of tests. I think that's what we see when we go back into Genesis chapter 22. I was trying to think of an example. What's a practical example? Now, this is not an exact parallel, but for me, it helped me grasp this idea of testing. My son Christopher just graduated from high school, and as he was coming towards the graduation, they asked him, he's a performing arts kind of guy. He's been involved in lots of theatrical productions and at the school where he attended. And they asked him if he would do something for the fine arts program that came up at the end of the year, for the senior fine arts program. And they asked him if he would do some magic. He's done some stage magic before, illusions and that kind of stuff. He got some of that from me, because I did that in college myself. And they asked him if he would do some magic. And so about a month before, he started asking, "Dad, can we build something that I can do for the fine arts program?" And so he prevailed upon me. And lo and behold, yes, I did build an illusion for him to do, and he helped me do it, and we put together what was called a substitution trunk. It's a pretty classic illusion. I'm a proud papa. I'll be glad to show you the videotape of my son doing it. He did a really fine job. But we spent a couple of weekends building this illusion, and then he spent hours and hours rehearsing with his assistant in order to do this. And then came the first time he was going to do it publicly, and he was shaking a little bit, a little frightened. This was like the test. But you know what? I was watching, I was going, not a problem. I've watched you rehearse. You've walked through it. You know it down cold. You will not have a problem. The test, that is the staging of the event that evening for the fine arts program, was merely the occasion for him to display what he already knew. Do you understand? That's the kind of test that God gives. He gives the children of Israel an opportunity to display what they already knew. Christopher's performance was an opportunity to put on display what he already knew. Abraham's test is going to be an opportunity to put on display what he already knew. And we need to read Genesis 22 with that kind of perspective. God's not setting Abraham up for failure. He's going to give Abraham an opportunity to put on display what Abraham already knows. And I want to explain that to you by going back to Genesis 22. Before we read, let's pray. Ask God to guide our thinking. And then we will explore Abraham's testing. Let's pray together. It is an incredible, an amazing thing to me, Lord, that by grace you have invited us into relationship. That is, you want life with us, and you open up for us life with you. This is amazing. By sending your Son, you have solved the problem of our sin and alienation, resolving the consequences of our wrongdoing on the cross, and now you invite us into deep friendship. We want to know what that's like. We want to know how to live there. And you tell me in the New Testament that Abraham is an example of that friendship, and you tell me in the Old Testament that he is your friend. And so this morning, as we open up this passage of Scripture, help us to understand what's going on with your friend and what it means for us. As we read these words from Genesis 22, please speak to our hearts. Help us hear what you want to tell us about our journey and friendship with you. Don't let this just be about getting facts and details about the story of Abraham's life. But like you met with Abraham, meet with us this morning. Like you spoke to Abraham, speak to us this morning. Like you drew Abraham into friendship, draw us ever deeper into friendship. Not just for our good, but for your glory. It is as friends of yours that we can best celebrate your goodness and glory, and your fame might spread. That is our prayer. So please meet with us today. Amen. Genesis 29. Let's look at this test, this opportunity, starting verse 1, chapter 22. Genesis 22. Now it came about after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. And Abraham replied, Here I am. And God said, Take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on the mountains of which I will tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son. And he split wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. And on the third day, Abraham raised his eyes and saw the place from a distance. And Abraham said to the young men who were with him, Stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go over there and we will worship and return to you. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife. And so the two of them walked on together. And Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, My father. And Abraham replied, Here I am, my son. And Isaac said, Behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. So the two of them walked on together. Then they came to the place of which God had told him, and Abraham built the altar there and arranged the wood and bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And Abraham said, Here I am. And God said, Do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him, for now I know you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Then Abraham raised his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the place of his son. And Abraham called the name of that place, Yahweh, the Lord will provide. As it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord it will be provided. And then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you. And I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. So Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba. And Abraham lived at Beersheba. Now, on the surface of it, this is a pretty plain, straightforward account. There's not much puzzling here. In fact, there's little to comment on in terms of the basic events, except to highlight how much the author points out Abraham's personal involvement in all of this. I mean, not telling us much about what's going on in Abraham's heart, the author does tell us a lot about what Abraham does. He hears from God, he rises early the next morning. He chops the wood of the sacrifice for himself. He saddles the donkey and makes a 3-day journey to Mount Moriah, walking alongside his son the whole time. He goes up the mountain holding the knife in one hand and taking fire in the other. Can you imagine how powerful these 3 days must have been for Abraham? Abraham going on this journey to carry out the instructions that God has given him. But it's right there that a question gets asked by many people. Abraham's about to carry out these instructions, sacrifice his son. Some people ask the question, how could God command the sacrifice of an innocent boy? What's God doing there in commanding Abraham to kill Isaac? As I think about that, typically there are three ways that that question gets answered. How is it? Why would God do that? Since clearly in the scriptures, taking innocent life is morally wrong. How could God command Abraham to kill Isaac? Three ways that I think that question gets answered. First, some people say that God wasn't serious. He was just kind of playing with Abraham. When he said, kill Isaac, your son, he didn't really mean that. He was just joshing, just kidding. But you know what? When I think about that, that makes God duplicitous. God's a deceiver. He said something he didn't really mean, something he really didn't intend. And that's inconsistent with the character of God. As I meet God in the pages of the Scriptures, he's not the kind to deceive or to play games. And so it's hard for me to think that when God commanded Abraham to offer Isaac, he wasn't serious. He was serious. He wasn't playing games. He meant what he said. Now, some people say, oh, God really did mean what he said when he told Abraham to offer Isaac, but God changed his mind. He thought about it later and decided, maybe that's not such a good idea. And so some think that what was going on there was that God really told Abraham to do it, but then later changed his mind. Oh, I made a mistake. That's probably not a really good idea, Abraham. Probably best not you do that. But I have a problem with that view also, because that suggests that God got it wrong. That God misspoke. That God misunderstood. God had second thoughts like, I think this is a really good idea. Oh, no, guess not. But the testimony of Scripture is not that our God is that kind of God. He's not misguided. He's not capricious. He doesn't make offhand remarks that he later has to regret. I'm sorry, I said that. You know what? Second thought, that's not such a good idea. So I don't think that God first said one thing and then decided later another thing. I can't hold that view either. Well, that means that what God told Abraham, he really intended. But I'd like to suggest that what's going on here might be understood this way. God was after something that could only be addressed in Abraham's life this way. God was after something that could only be addressed in Abraham's life this way. That is, God drew on where Abraham was and how Abraham thinks and what was going on in Abraham's life in order to get at something in Abraham's soul and the call to sacrifice Isaac was something that Abraham could understand, that something that Abraham could deal with and that would stir in Abraham what God intended to stir in Abraham. Even though I do not believe God ultimately was going to have Isaac killed. Do you hear what I'm saying? God intended for Abraham to take these very steps and needed Abraham to heed the command to kill Isaac. Although God did not intend ultimately the killing of Isaac, he was intending what was going on in Abraham's soul. And I've been trying to wrestle with this, try to understand this. How might we picture this? I think, although it's not an exact parallel, I think one of the ways to think about this is to think about what sometimes happens between parent and child. Your child is doing something, or they intend to do something, they're planning to do A, and you look at it, and you know, there's no way they can do A. They don't have enough skill, they don't have enough understanding, there's no way they're going to be able to pull off A. And they start to do A, and you come up as parent, and you say, can I help you? And they say, like all good children, no thank you, I'm going to do this by myself. And you'll hear your kids say that. No thank you, I'm going to do this by myself. I can handle this, I can do this by myself. And what's the proper parental response? It's, do that. That's the proper parent response. Do that. Tell them. Do that. Because in the attempt to do that, they're going to discover something that they cannot discover if you tell them, no, don't do that. You'll never be able to do that. Do you understand what I'm saying? Parents sometimes will tell their children, do that, with the full intention that the child will apply themselves fully to do that, knowing fully well that they're not going to do that. Do you understand? That's not duplicitous. That's not deceptive. That is, in fact, I want you to give yourself fully to doing that because there's something in the giving yourself fully to doing that that you will have to learn that you cannot learn any other way. And that's what I think is going on with Abraham. Parallel. Not identical, but parallel. God commands Abraham to do something that he wants Abraham to give himself fully to, although, from the way the story ends, I don't think God was intending for Isaac to be killed. He was intending for something to go on in the heart of Abraham. And that's what goes on. Something profound goes on in the heart of Abraham. So let's focus a little bit about what's going on here. And in order to do that, I want to highlight two things that you might miss. There's something that you might miss in chapter 22, verse 1. And then there might be something you might miss about Abraham himself. So let's look at 22:1. There are two things there to be noticed. 22:1 starts this way. Now it came about after these things. That's an interesting construction. This expression, after these things, it doesn't mean that what we're about to read simply follows in time after what's happened. It's a logical connection. The language is such to suggest that what we're about to read actually is logically connected to what preceded. Now you need to notice that because, I mean, like most English Bibles, you got a big chapter heading right there, chapter 22, and it's got a heading that says, Abraham sacrifices Isaac, or something like that. Well, the story doesn't break there. Chapter 22, verse 1 is actually a continuation of what has immediately preceded. And the language that the author uses, that is Moses under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, is trying to tell us, no. This that we're about to read is connected to what is immediately preceded. What immediately preceded this? That's what we looked at last week. What immediately preceded this? Abraham planted a tree and called on the name of Yahweh, the everlasting God. What immediately preceded this was Abraham's confession. You are everything to me. In a changing world, you are the unchanging, stable center point of my life. Remember, we talked about everlasting not meaning simply long living, but stable, solid, enduring, reliable. You are that for me. That's what Abraham has just confessed at the close of chapter 21. Chapter 22 opening. Now after these things, what things? After Abraham's confession and calling on the name of the everlasting God, in light of that, chapter 22 happens. That's what you need to notice about 22:1. After these things, in light of that confession. Now there's another clue that that's what's going on. In chapter 22, verse 1, the other thing not to overlook is, it says, now after these things, God tested Abraham. Now, the English translation doesn't reflect this very well, but there's an interesting construction that goes on there when it says that God tested Abraham. It's literally, the God tested Abraham. Now, that doesn't come up very often in the Old Testament, where the article, the, is used with God. But this is literally, the God tested Abraham. And if you were a good Hebrew, a good Jew reading the scriptures, and you saw the God, then you'd ask the question, oh, which God? Why highlight that? That construction is typically used to call your attention to what's been revealed about God in the context. It would be like us saying, that God tested Abraham, i.e., which God? Oh, the God that Abraham is identifying as the everlasting God, the one who is the very center point of his life, the unchanging, enduring, dependable center of his life. That God is the one who tests Abraham. So again, the author is trying to help us see that chapter 22 is merely flowing out of chapter 21. This test, this opportunity that's coming to Abraham is all about Abraham's confession. Abraham has just confessed, you are it. You are the everlasting God. You are the unchanging center point of my life. And in the context of that, God says, let's see how that plays out for Abraham. And that's what happens here. The test has everything to do with Abraham's confession of and reliance upon God. Now, when we look at the test itself, that is what Abraham ends up doing, the focus is often brought down on his deeds, on the thing that he does. And that's important. I think it's important to notice that Abraham goes all the way. There's no argument there. That's huge. He really intended to carry out God's instructions to him. That is, he goes all the way, raises the knife over his son, intending to slay Isaac. But if you only stop with his actions, then it leaves me a question. That is, if I only focus on what Abraham does, then I'm left with some troubling questions. Things like, so why did Abraham do this? Why does he do this thing, taking Isaac and going to sacrifice him? Is Abraham merely knuckling under to the pressure that God is bringing on him? What's going on in Abraham's soul? Why does Abraham do this? Does he do this begrudgingly? Is he dragging his heels as he's going up Mount Moriah? Is he mumbling under his breath, this is really a bad idea, but... Has he been backed into a corner? Maybe he's just going through the motions. I'm just doing this, but I don't really want to. What's really going on? I think that's more important. It's not about the behavior. It's about really what's going on in Abraham's soul. And so in order to get to that question, what's going on in Abraham's soul, we have to look beyond just his behavior. But fortunately, the text gives us some clues. What you can't miss, don't overlook what Abraham says. Because what Abraham says is what gives me a clue into what's going on in Abraham's soul, what's going on in his heart. So let's look at the four things, four times Abraham speaks in the chapter, and they tell me, they're the barometer, they're the window into his heart, tell me what's going on in his soul. Here's the first thing, Genesis 22, 1, God says, Abraham, Abraham responds, English translations renders it, here am I. It's actually just one Hebrew word. Literally, the Hebrew word means, look me, look me. That's what it means. It's hineni, Hebrew word hineni. Look me. What's the sense of that word? Let me take you to another place in the Old Testament so that you can get a picture of what that word means. Keep your finger there in chapter 22 if you want and turn. Or not. Just listen. Chapter 37. Israel. The name for the man named Jacob. Jacob, Israel, same guy. He has 12 sons. God's going to ultimately fulfill his promises made to Abraham through Jacob and his 12 sons. But in chapter 37, Jacob has 12 sons. Joseph is his favored son. All the sons are out tending sheep except for Joseph. So Jacob, Israel, is going to send Joseph to check on the sons. That's what the setting is. Chapter 37 of Genesis, verse 13. Israel says to Joseph, are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send you to them. And Joseph said, what's he say? I will go. No, he actually says, hineni. Very same words that Abraham uses. So good translation to say, I will go. But all he says is the same word that Abraham says. When God says, Abraham, Abraham says, hineni, here am I. Look me, I'm the one. That's what Joseph says. Israel says, I'm going to send you to check on the brothers. And what does Joseph say? Hineni, me, I'm the one, I'll do that. That's what Abraham is saying to God when God calls on Abraham. Abraham says, I'm the one, I'm at your disposal, I do what you want. That's what it means. When he responds, here am I, he's saying more than just, I'm present. He is saying, I'm at your disposal. I'm at your beck and call. I will go. I'll do what you want to do. That's what he says. It's the same word. It's a marvelous passage in the book of Isaiah. Isaiah sees a vision of the Lord in Isaiah chapter 6. And he is just amazed at the glory of God. And as he has this encounter with the living God, God, in a sense, raises the question, who will take my message to my people? God is looking for a messenger. Who will take my message to my people? In Isaiah chapter 6, verse 8, when Isaiah sees a vision of the Lord and hears that, you know what Isaiah says? Same thing Abraham says. It ain't he. Me. Look me. I'm the one. I'll go. I'm at your disposal. That's what it means. So the first thing to see as Abraham begins this test is that the disposition of his heart is, when God calls, what does Abraham say? I'm at your disposal. I'm your man. Here am I. Hineni. That's what he says. That's the first thing. Gives us some insight into his heart. Now, the second time Abraham speaks, there's some other things going on there in Abraham's heart. Genesis chapter 22, verse 5. They get to Mount Moriah, and after this three-day journey, and Abraham is going to go on further and is going to leave the servants with the donkey. So in chapter 22, verse 5, Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go over there, and we will worship and return to you. Now, two things to note here. After the statement of fact, that is, donkey, you stay, then Abraham tells us what's going on, how he sees things. And he says two things. First, he says, this is about worship. Did you hear that? This is what he says. I and the boy are going to go worship. This isn't about work. It's about deeds. This is about worship. Abraham is confessing something about what's going on in his heart. And this word of worship, it's a powerful word. There are a couple of different words that can be used to speak about worship in the Old Testament. This is a word that literally means to bow down, to submit because of the magnitude and glory of the other, to give yourself to literally to bow down. You have in your notes a reference to Genesis 37. That's, again, drawing from the Joseph story because there's a picture of this word in Genesis 37, verses 7 and 8. Joseph, that favored brother, he has a dream. And in his dream, all of the sons of Israel are stacking up piles of grain in the field. And Joseph has a dream. He says, we were all out in the field stacking up bunches of grain, and your bunches bowed down to my bunch. That's the same word that's used here for Abraham's response to God, worship. Your bunches bowed down, worshipped, did obeisance, submitted to. And you know how the brothers responded? They go, we're not giving in to you. You think we're going to be ruled by you? You think we're going to acquiesce to you? No way. That context, Genesis 37, helps you understand the significance of this word. It's not simply that Abraham was saying, I'm going to go sing songs to God. He's saying, I'm laying it out before him. This is all about my worship. This is all about my submission to him. Abraham is talking about what's on his heart, and as he's thinking about going up the mountain with his son, he's saying, this is all about my submissive worship to God who is over all to me. But then you hear what else he says to the servants? He says, we're going to go worship. And then he says this remarkable thing, and we're going to return. We are going to return. What do you do with that? I think that's huge. For Abraham, although he doesn't know how it's going to happen, he intends to return with Isaac. That's amazing. Because it's really clear that Abraham fully intends to carry out God's instructions. You read the account? There's no way. He's not going short. He's going to carry out the instructions. But somehow in the midst of all of this, you see, Abraham has been walking with God long enough that he knows the things that God has promised. Specifically, Isaac. Your descendants are going to come through Isaac. It is going to be that son through whom your seed will be multiplied. God has reiterated that and has made an unilateral agreement with Abraham that that's going to happen. I don't think Abraham has a clue as to how it's going to happen. But here's what's going on in Abraham's mind and heart. I'm going to go worship. This is all about God and me being rightly oriented and submissive to him. And I don't understand it, but Isaac's life is about to be forfeit. But because I trust God and know what he has told me, somehow we're coming back. That's huge. That is huge. Abraham is confessing his confidence that somehow God is also working in this process, although he doesn't quite see it or understand it. We get a commentary on what's going on with Abraham all the way in the New Testament book of Hebrews. It's in Hebrews chapter 11 where there's a little, in a sense, commentary on Abraham's experience here. It's in Hebrews chapter 11, verses 17 through 19. Hebrews chapter 11, verses 17 through 19. We read, "By faith, Abraham, when he was tested," passage we're talking about, "offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. It was he to whom it was said, 'In Isaac your descendants shall be called.' And Abraham considered that God is able to raise people even from the dead." That's the commentary on what's going on with Abraham. What's Abraham doing? I think Abraham is saying, when he says, we're going to worship and we're coming back, I think Abraham is confessing, I don't quite get this. It's over for Isaac, but it's not over for Isaac. Isaac's life is forfeit, but Isaac is still the son of promise. I have confidence in God that somehow we're coming back. And so then again, we see something about the heart of Abraham in the midst of this. Now, the third time Abraham speaks, boy, this is a huge picture. In Genesis chapter 22, Isaac, who's in his early teens by this time, is walking with his dad up Mount Moriah. Isaac's carrying the wood. Dad is carrying the knife and the fire. Isaac knows that a sacrifice is about to be made, and he's puzzled. So he asks Dad. Verse 7, Isaac spoke to his father. It says, "Behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" And Abraham says, "God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." When Abraham says God will provide, he uses the word that means to see. God will see. It's like what we use in English when sometimes if something needs to be done and you say, "I'll see to that." That will be my responsibility. I will carry that out. I will take responsibility for making sure that that happens. That's the word that's used here for provide. God will see to it. But notice how Abraham puts it. He says that God will see to it for himself. Abraham's telling me something about what's going on in his soul here. Abraham's helping us understand what's going on. When he says that God will see to it for himself, what he's saying is that God will provide for himself what is needed for this to happen. And I don't think that Abraham's being deceptive with Isaac. I think Abraham's speaking his heart. As Abraham looks at this situation, he is thinking, God's providing for himself what's necessary. Well, clearly, how did he get Isaac? God's doing. Who provided that son? God did. Who's providing the sacrifice? God. And so although as we read the story and we know where it comes out, we know that God provides in a different way, but Abraham's making the confession, all of this is being carried out under the provision of God. What he is doing for himself, he is providing for himself so that what he wants to have happen in all of this will happen. That's the confession that Abraham's making. God himself is seeing to this, that it will happen the way he intends. It's more than just Abraham's admission that I'm going to do this. It is that God, in the giving and in the taking away, in the instructions and the promises and the instructions to the sacrifice, that all of this, all of my worship, Abraham is saying, is about what God is doing for his good, for his benefit, for his glory. It's all about what God is providing for himself in what I'm doing. Do you hear that? Abraham makes a huge confession there about this is not just about me. It's about what God is doing for himself in the midst of my life. And then comes the last thing we hear from Abraham. And for me, this is like huge. Chapter 22, verse 11. This is the last words that we hear from Abraham. As Abraham has his knife in hand, the fire ready, he is about to strike his son. The angel of the Lord calls to him from heaven, and God says, "Abraham," and Abraham replies, "Here am I." same words that he started with. Hineni, I'm at your disposal. I'm at your beck and call, whatever you want. To me, that's just massive. Because I don't know about you, but I think about what it must have been like those 3 days' journey. Can you imagine those 3 days' journey? What is going through Abraham's mind, what he is thinking. I don't get this. I waited decades for this son. I tried to make it happen, and I didn't make it happen right, and it was wrong, and God spoke, and God blessed, and then God made covenants, and I don't get this. I don't understand. This is messing with my whole view of how things should happen. I am really confused about this. I know this is about worship. I know it's what I'm supposed to do. I don't quite get this. I'm going to do it. I don't understand it. And in the midst of doing that, God speaks and says, Abraham, and if it were me, you know what I would say? Can we talk later? My life is pretty much a mess as it is right now. I don't want to hear anything more from you right now. I'm trying to get just through this day. Last time you spoke to me, my world came unraveled. Don't say anything else right now. But how does Abraham respond? I'm at your beck and call. Whatever you want. I'm your man. Speak. I'm listening. That's what he responds. That's what he says. That's at the heart of this test. That's what's going on with Abraham. That's what lets me see into his soul. Abraham's actions tell me a little bit about what's going on with Abraham, but Abraham's words tell me a whole lot more. They let me see into his soul. Let me try to recap it for you. Just reviewing the words. 22:1, he says, here am I. Abraham is saying, I'm at your disposal, God. You are it to me. Everything. What you say, I'm good. I'll do. I'm at your disposal. The second time we hear him speak, he says, and this is all about worship. It's about my willing giving myself to you because of how great you are. And I don't understand how this is going to play out. But I know we're coming back. And he's saying, I'm doing what I'm doing because my life is oriented around the worship of you. And I am confident that you're going to be good to your promises, even if I don't see it. Even if I don't know how it's going to play out, I'm still going to worship you. I'm still going to do what you intend for me to do because it's all about my willing admission that you are the center of my life. It's about worship. You're going to play it out because I trust you. I depend on you. I don't know how, but that won't keep me from worshiping. And in fact, the third thing he says that God will provide Abraham is saying, although I can't see how things will play out, you are providing everything that's needed for this life to be lived the way you want it to be lived. And he caps it off by repeating again, no matter what, I'm at your disposal. No matter what, you are the everlasting God. I am radically given over to you because you are the one unchanging thing in my life. I'm holding tightly unto you. And Abraham passes the test. How do we know? Because God reconfirms the promises. It's not a new thing. God simply affirms what he's already told Abraham. Abraham, we're going forward. All that I've said to you, I will bring to pass. Here am I. We're going to go and worship and we'll return. God himself will provide all that's necessary. Here am I. That's what tells me what's going on in Abraham's soul. And when I see that, when I look at Abraham and the way he lives this as a real guy, I want to ask the question, so what am I supposed to learn myself from Abraham's example here? What's the Spirit telling me about my life and my friendship and my journey with God from this passage with Abraham's life? Let me suggest two things. One, let me suggest what the passage is not about. And then let me suggest what the passage really is about. What is the passage not really telling us? Hear me. God is not saying, I'm going to take from you the thing you love most. I've heard this passage taught that way. That is not what God is saying, I don't think. God's going to take from you the one thing you love most so you don't make an idol of it. I don't think that's what's going on. This is not primarily what's in focus. It's not about competing loves. It is about Abraham having the opportunity to demonstrate that what he says about God is really what he believes about God. This is about the opportunity that Abraham has to live as if God was the everlasting God, because that's what he says. You are the everlasting God. So Abraham, put feet to that. Put it into practice. live in the reality of your declared dependence on me. That's what's going on. This is not primarily about let go of Isaac. It is primarily about hold tightly unto me. That's what God is after. Listen, Abraham is not supposed to stop loving Isaac deeply. I think sometimes this gets pitched wrong. And we're afraid to love our kids or our spouse deeply. Oh, I don't want to love them too much, because if I love them too much, then what? God's going to... That's not what's going on here. Isaac is not simply the object of Abraham's love. Isaac is everything. He's the promise. He's the covenant. I mean, it's all wrapped up in Isaac. And all that God is asking is, Abraham, you said Isaac's not it all, but I'm it all. All I'm asking you to do, he's just giving Abraham the chance to live as if God really was all. Why? Because Abraham says, you're everything to me. You're my everlasting God. You are the thing that is enduringly stable in my life. You are what is at the core of my life. That is how I call on you. God simply says, own that, Abraham. That's what's going on here. So I want to suggest it's not that God's going to take the thing that you love most away from you. But let me then suggest what it really is all about. That God is giving Abraham an opportunity to own what he affirmed about God for Abraham's own good. Hear me? What's going on is that God is giving Abraham the opportunity to own, get his arms around what he says he believes about God for whose good? For Abraham's good. For whose benefit? For Abraham's benefit. God doesn't learn anything in this exchange. Although the language says that God says, now I know, it's not like, I don't think when God begins this experience with Abraham that he's up there biting his divine fingernails and pulling at his divine beard. I wonder how this is going to turn out. I've made some promises to Abraham. I sure hope he comes through, because then I'm going to have to go back on my... I don't think that's the way it is. In the New Testament, we're told that God does not allow us to enter into tests that he does not know, already know, how we're going to come through. He knew how Abraham was going to come through. This is not about the increase in God's knowledge of Abraham, nor about the growth in God's affections for Abraham. Who's growing in this? Not God. Who's growing in this? Abraham. God is giving Abraham the opportunity to live in the experience of the reality of the confession that he makes. You are everything to me. Come on. That's what God's saying. Come on. Live there. That's what's going on. That's what's going on here. This is the test for Abraham's benefit, not for God's. This is a growing time so that Abraham can mature and deepen in his life with God, not so that God can become more committed to Abraham. God's already made a unilateral, I'm forever with you, Abraham. This is so Abraham can come to realize the reality of this truth that he affirms. This is the opportunity to demonstrate for Abraham's benefit that he can live as if God was the thing he prizes most. So Abraham can say, I got it. I'm there. You are what I prize most. That's what's going on. I've been trying to get my arms around this and try to find ways to think about this. In John chapter 6, Jesus is teaching a large group of disciples, and these people have been following him, some of them more, some of them less. They've been hanging around for a long time. They've been listening to him teach. And he starts to teach some hard stuff. John chapter 6, he starts to say things like, well, unless you eat the flesh of the blood of the Son of Man and drink, flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, then you don't have life. Some of the disciples are like, whoa, that's pretty weird. Don't know what to do with that. And he starts to explain to them some more about what life with him is all about. And John tells us in John chapter 6 that some of these who were listening to him said, I'm not walking with you anymore. That's a little too weird for me. And Jesus turns to Peter and he says, would you like to leave too? You can go. What's going on there? This is a test for Peter. Not because there's something wicked going on in Peter's heart. Not because Peter loves something more than he loves Jesus. But he needs to be able to put feet to it. So Jesus looks at Peter and says, You don't have to keep following me. And what does Peter say? John 6, 68, he says, where else would I go? Because you're the only one that has the words of eternal life. I'm not leaving you because you're it for me. Peter has an Abraham moment. You're it for me. But how do we get to the place where we live like you're it for me? We have to have experiences where we get to say, you're it for me. That's what's going on with Abraham. I think about Jesus and the disciples. The disciples, Jesus has sent the disciples out in the boat. These are fishermen. They've been in a boat before. Big boat. They sailed before. They're in the boat, and a storm has arisen on the sea. And the boat is rocking and shaking. They're pretty afraid. They've been rowing all night. It should have been a short trip across the lake. They've been rowing since 6. It's now 3 in the morning. Jesus comes walking to them on the water. They are scared for their lives. They don't know what's going on, why they can't get across the sea. And Jesus looks at Peter and goes, hey, Peter, come walk with me on the water. For whose benefit was that experience? Jesus knows what it's like to walk on the water. Jesus knows he can. Jesus, in fact, knows that he can get Peter to walk on the water. Who doesn't know? Who doesn't have the experience? Peter. Can you imagine what it was like for Peter to be in the boat? We're talking not just a little rowboat. We're talking about a big boat. And have to climb up over the side of the boat. Throw one leg and then the other leg over the boat. Hang on. Looking back. There he is. He's calling me. What am I going to do? This is a test. Jesus is going, hey, Peter, you said on your whole life, you said I am what you want to live for. Come walk with me. What does Peter have to do? He has to let go of everything else and hold on to Jesus. For whose benefit is that? Peter's? For whose benefit is this test? Abraham's? The very best thing for Abraham is to live as if God was everything to him. That would be the very best thing for Abraham. That would be the very best thing for you and me if we lived as if God were the very best thing for us. So why does God orchestrate all this for Abraham? So that Abraham can live, experientially live the reality of what he says. God, you are everything to me. God goes, come on. Peter says, Jesus, you're it for me. Jesus goes, come on. Walk that out. Because once you do, back to Chris's magic trick. If you see the video, I'm being a proud papa, I'd be glad to show you the video. He does a stellar job. If you watch the video, I'm videotaping, and you can tell because when he pulls it off, there's a huge cheer going on. And I tried to back up from the camera so that I didn't just dominate, but you can hear me in the background. Yes! I'm just like over the top. Why? Because I knew he could do it. I knew he could do it. Who didn't know he could do it? Chris? He had some doubts. I had no doubts. I'd watched him practice. I knew what he was able to do. And this was the opportunity to do it. Friends, I think, as this story came to a close, if God ever pumps his fist, he's pumping his fist. Yes! Abraham, that's what I want for you to know that I am everything to you, for you to experience that, for you to live there, because that's what's best for you. That's what's going on. And we see it in Abraham's confession. We see it in Abraham's words. When we begin to come to know God in personal relationship, the very best thing for us is to find in him our all. And we need to get to the place where we can say with Abraham, I am at your disposal. I am at your disposal because you are my everlasting God. At the heart of everything that I am doing is worship. I am giving myself to worship you, even though I'm not sure how it's all going to play out. Sometimes it looks like your promises may not be carried out, but I know you're good to your word, so I'm still going to worship you. And you will provide everything that's necessary for this life of worship to be lived. That's what Abraham's saying. I'm at your disposal. Here am I. I'm yours. That's the journey of friendship. That's what he wants for us. So it's going on in Genesis chapter 22. Let's go there. Let's pray. Amazing, Lord, that Abraham matters so much to you, that you move in his life so that he comes to prize that which is most to be prized, you. You so work in his life so that he comes to embrace you as the thing that is most to be valued, because you are the thing most to be valued, and so you work in our lives as well. Abraham hears your word and responds in worship. So this morning we've heard your word. Would you draw us now into worship? Allow us to say, here am I. I am fully devoted and given over to you. I'm at your beck and call. My life is given to you in worship. Whether I see how your promises will play out or not, I know that you will provide everything and all that is necessary for this life to be lived. So, I am at your disposal. Here am I to worship you.